أشهد أن محمد رسول الله. أشهد أن
السلام عليكم and welcome to Islam in Focus. Tonight's program is the 50th in the series Sources of Islam, and tonight we have a new topic. It's on the translations of the Quran. I'm your host, Rashad Mimish, and here with me, as usual, Dr. Jamal Bidawi from St. Mary's University. Assalamu alaikum, Dr. Jamal.
Wa alaikum salam.
Dr. Jamal, maybe I'll start off by asking you what the term translation actually means in reference to the Quran.
Well, some jurists or scholars like Manaf Qattan, for example, in chapter 24 of his book about the studies in the Quran, make a distinction between three meanings. I'm talking here not about the broader term of translation, but as you said, how it relates to the Quran. First is the literal translation, that is, to try to translate from one language into the other in full, literally, including the style, including the order, even which the words appear in the sentence. And as you know, that this is impossible, perhaps in any language, because of a number of reasons. Sometimes, for example, the order in which the things may appear vary from one language to the other. In English, for example, when you want to describe a rose as red, you don't say rose red, you say red rose. In Arabic, it is the opposite. You say wardatun hamra, which if you translate very literally, it means rose red. So the meaning and the structure of language varies. Secondly, no matter how much the person try to translate, you cannot fully take everything and the context and the variety of meanings from one language and put it in so many words in another language. That's general, I suppose, for any translation. But this difficulty is even magnified and more so in the case of translation of the Arabic language, because the Arabic language has certain unique characteristics, you might say, and might touch on that later, which make it even more difficult to translate. And that is even more difficult in the case of the Quran, because the Quran actually is the summit or the height, the top example, standard, if you will, of eloquence in the Arabic language. For that reason, we find that many jurists say that anyone who claims to make literal translation of the Quran is really mistaken, and that's forbidden, because after all, the word of Allah, which is the Quran according to Muslim belief, is the word as it came to Prophet Muhammad through Angel Gabriel. So any translation of the word of Allah cannot be the word of Allah. It's a translation of the meaning of the word of Allah. And that leads us to the second meaning of translation as it relates to the Quran. And that's what you might call non-literal translation, a translation that tries or attempts to convey the meaning. But even when you say it only conveys the meaning, it depends what kind of meanings you're talking about. Again, you could talk about basic, conclusive type of meanings or messages which anyone can understand once you understand the meaning of the word. And that's possible, you could do that. But sometimes there are also secondary or implicit meanings in one language which are almost impossible to translate to another language, especially if you consider eloquence and the words that might be dropped or added for eloquent, to maintain the eloquence and the style of the language. This you can't really translate fully. Thirdly, particularly in the opinion of Manna al-Qattan, that we can speak more about the Quran as interpretive translation, not even literal or non-literal, but even more specifically, interpretive translation. Why? Because when the person tries or attempts to translate a verse or chapter in the Quran, And it, when it's impossible to convey the full meaning, it means that the person is applying some kind of understanding of his or her. And as such, what he's telling people really, this is not even the translation of the meaning of the Quran, this is more or less like my understanding of that verse of the Quran, without claiming that this covers all possible meanings of that verse. But that all assumes even that the translator has reasonable or have reasonable command on the on both languages, the Arabic and the English, for example, in case of translation into English. But this problem is even much greater in the case of people who tried to translate the Quran not from the original Arabic text, but from some other translation that was made before. And this is the problem that happened historically.
I see. Now, speaking historically then, how did translations actually develop?
A very nice review of the of that particular issue, in brief, is was presented in the book that we cited before by Dr. Muhammad Khalifa, called The Sublime Quran. He's done a very good job in this summary, and perhaps you can draw from his work or borrow for this particular program. And basically, it is indicated that in the very beginning, that is in the days of the Prophet, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, there was no need really for translation of the Quran or the meaning of the Quran for a number of reasons. First, in the immediate environment of the Prophet, the initial recipients of the message through whom it was supposed to spread to others, they knew the Arabic language, and the Arabic language at that time actually reached its ultimate maturity, and it was highly developed, very mature. So they had full understanding of the message of the Quran. Secondly, you might ask, how about other nations or peoples who embraced Islam later when it spread to other lands? Again, historically, we know that once Islam spread to other lands, the residents of these lands were very eager to learn Arabic, and many of those whose mother tongue was not Arabic become just as good and as conversant in Arabic as the Arabs themselves. And we find Arabic became the, you know, the language to understand the Quran. A third reason is that in the initial period of Islamic history, and actually for hundreds of years thereafter, Islam became perhaps the superpower of, in the world at that time. It became the language of science and civilization in the same way, for example, that today people would have to learn some of the major languages like English and French or whatever, German, as the languages of science, where a person would have to learn them to understand these sciences. The reverse was true at that time. It was the Arabic language that was the language of civilization and sciences, and in a previous series we discussed in some detail some of the great contribution of Muslims to civilization, and for those who are interested, I'd like to refer them to the multi-volume excellent work by George Sarton, S-A-R-T-O-N, from Harvard University, called Introduction to the History of Sciences. Now, Islam being as powerful as it was at that time, of course, or Muslims, I should say, language, the Arabic language became the language that perhaps was a second language for many people, regardless of their linguistic background. Now, as far as the West is concerned, we find that the first translation of the Quran in some of the European languages took place in 1143. So, this is talking about the mid-12th century. However, amazingly enough, it took almost 400 years before that translation was available in print. I'm not acting here as a historian trying to analyze possible reasons, but I think possibly the attitudes toward Islam and Muslims in medieval times could have been possibly one of the contributing reasons, not necessarily the sole reason, but some of the reasons why some institutions were not very much particular about other people having access to the Quran. Whatever the reason was, we find that this initial translation, which was into Latin, that other translations began to emerge. For example, in 1647, a translation of the Quran into French was made. But as some scholars, including non-Muslim scholars like George Sale, indicated that this translation was full of errors virtually in every page, including additions and deletions from the text of the Quran. However, strange enough, this French translation of the 17th century was a basis for another English translation in 1688, the same century, by Alexander Ross, which of course you can tell would be as bad as the one which was the basis for it, that's the French translation. Then many other translations into English used the Latin version that we mentioned before as its basis, especially the one that was made by Father Maracci. It's M-A-R-A-C-C-I, which was made in 1698. One example of a very famous translation of the meaning of the Quran, which was based on this Latin translation, was the one by George Sale, S-A-L-E, which was published in 1734. But contrary to what some scholars used to think, George Sale did not really master the Arabic language, and maybe that's why he used the Latin as his base for translation. But in spite of the errors, numerous errors in Sale's translation, it went through nearly 30 printings, 30. See, it was translated also into Dutch, German, French, Swedish, Bulgarian. After that, several attempts were made to translate the Quran into English, but again they used George Sale translation as its basis, or any other non-Arabic version. So it suffers from the same kind of problems, again, second-hand type of translation, simply multiplying or continuing with the same errors. Examples of these are Radwell's translation, 1861, Palmer, 1880, Bell, 1939. And then finally, in about 1955, Arbery published a translation which was based on the Arabic original, as different from the previous second-hand type of translations. That was acclaimed by many Orientalists like Watt and Williams as a very good one, reasonably acceptable. That's from their standpoint. And finally, in the 20th century, to make the story short, there have been several translations attempted by either Muslims who were born Muslims, or those who became Muslims from European origin, including people like Abdul Hakim Khan, Muhammad Ali, Abdullah Yusuf Ali, which is a very popular translation readily available in North America. And among those who embraced Islam, it include the Britisher Marmaduke Pictel, an Austrian, Muhammad Asad, and by the way, a Canadian also, Tom Irving. I don't know whether it has been published yet, but I knew from him that he completed his work. So this is just a sort of glimpse of how these translations developed throughout history.
Now, it would seem to me that this problem of translating from one language to the other is not a unique one, that it would probably exist when you're translating between any two languages. Would you agree?
Well, I agree with that. In fact, in some of the initial remarks that you said, there are some aspects of translations, of course, that would be quite difficult regardless of the which language you're translating to or from. However, maybe we should elaborate a little bit on one remark that was made earlier when I said that in the case of Arabic, the Arabic language, there are certain characteristics for that language that makes it more difficult to translate, in addition to peculiar characteristic of the Quran also as the standard for the Arabic language. Now, when the Arabic language, as Dr. Khalifa said, is used expertly and really meticulously. And I quote him on page 66. It is remarkably terse, rich, and forceful language. Other description given: striking, vivid, tender, and breathtaking. Now, this is not necessarily just an opinion of an enthusiast believer. In fact, as indicated in one of the earlier programs, that even the enemies of the Prophet at his time, who used to fight him and try to discredit him and discredit the Quran and everything else, they themselves, at night, used to slip quietly to try to get closer to the Prophet to hear him while he's reciting the Quran at night, which means that they were so impressed with the power and strength, not only of the meaning, but the style even of the Quran, that they could not resist listening to it. Even some of the scholars who were non-Arab, and non-Muslims at the same time, like the Orientalist Gibb, G-I-B-B, says, and I quote him, "No man has ever played on that deep-toned instrument with such power, such boldness, and such range of emotional effects." And then continues later to say, "To anyone who has not heard the sonorous majesty of an Arab reciting the Quran, it is impossible to convey what the book lacks in English, French, or German." Now, Gibb, G-I-B-B here, actually came very close in these statements to admitting that the origin of the Quran cannot be human, that it has a divine origin, even though he didn't really say it. Because according to his own words, he says that there is no parallel really in history to the Quran, that no person ever had the impact or any speech that had the impact and the power of the Quran. Which means that if there is no parallel whatsoever, why do we have to say that this is a unique case, especially if we know that Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was unlettered. He was not known to be a writer or a poem. He didn't even know how to read or write. And even his own words, other than the Quran, that's outside what he utters by way of dictation to him by the angel of revelation, is quite different in style from the Quran. So that leaves us with the question here, where did this Quran come from? It is not really strange, despite all of these problems with translation, that some of the, you might say, half-decent translations of the Quran, where there is an honest attempt to convey as much as possible of its meaning, if not part of the style of the Quran, was strong enough and powerful enough to motivate people even who didn't understand Arabic and who are not Muslims to embrace Islam. On this station, in a previous interview that we had about a year ago, we had an interview with Yusuf Islam, who was previously known as Cat Stevens, a super pop musician from Britain who became Muslim. And he indicated that one of the most powerful things in his life that really changed his life all around, even though he didn't know anything about Islam, was reading the Quran, not from the original, but even through some of those English translations. Cat Stevens' case is not the only one. There have been numerous cases like that, despite all of these problems of translation.
Now, you've mentioned about the problems of translating. Maybe I'll ask you to give some examples of these, to explain to us exactly what these problems are.
Well, in the Arabic language, we find there's rich vocabulary, perhaps richer than many other languages. And many times the very same word in Arabic may have different shades of meanings, right? And if someone attempts to translate, he simply tried to select one English word, let's say, let's concentrate on translation into English. He tried to find an English term, for example, that covers that meaning. And that does not really convey the fullness of the meaning of the Quran. Let me give some specific examples. In the Arabic language, there are two words, istata'a and istaa'a. Both of these normally are translated into English as being able to. Whereas, in fact, one of them talks about being able to do an easy task. The other one refers to being able to do a more difficult task. You see the subtleties of the meaning. But again, in English, he simply says, able to. Okay? There are a number of terms, for example, that are more or less like divine attributes of Allah. Like Khaliq, Khalaq, Fatir, Badi', Bari'. All of these terms normally are translated something like creator or originators. Whereas, again, without taking so much time, I've already given some illustration. Each one of them has a particular shadow of meaning, a particular emphasis that does not exactly or is not exactly equal or equivalent to the other terms. When you describe again Allah or talk about some of his attributes as Malik, 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 well, these are normally translated as something like owner of the universe or king, whereas again there are variations in the meaning of each of these. And the same thing goes on in a variety of other expressions, which I hope that illustrates that you can't really find one single term in English, for example, that conveys all these shades of meaning, whereas the original can give easily this kind of variations of meaning. Another problem is that there are some words in Arabic that even though the meaning could be understood by the English translator, let's say, there is no one single word that conveys the meaning in English, and you have to have a sentence. An example of this is when the Quran speaks about the origin of the human, talking particularly about embryology, and that the human is created from nutfa. That's one single word in Arabic. But when you try to translate nutfa into English, the closest thing, as Dr. Maurice Bouquet said, was a small quantity of liquid, referring to the initial process of fertilization of the ovum. But again, there's no one single word to say nutfa. You have to use a sentence to convey the meaning. Even the word that may have a concise and specific meaning, sometimes there are errors in translation that changes the meaning altogether. For example, in Surah 53 in verse 4, the Quran speaks about the Quran as wahyun yuha. The proper translation actually is revelation which is revealed, that is revelation from Allah. However, we find a translator like Robinson says it is suggestion suggested instead of revelation revealed. Again, this is not the proper meaning of the term, and actually it biases the meaning altogether from revelation coming from Allah to suggestion. And as you know, suggestion can come from within yourself or from some other human being. So that seems to get totally out of the meaning and the context of the verse in the Quran. Sometimes also a translation of one word may lead, even though it could be correct literally, but it could mean, again, something quite different from what the Quran speaks about, unless one is extremely careful and is translating within the context of the Quran. An example of this that Dr. Khalifa, for example, states is in Surah 52, in verse 43, تَعَالَ اللَّهُ عَمَّا يَقُولُونَ عَلُوًا كَبِيرًا. The proper translation of this is Allah is highly exalted above those they associate with him, that Allah doesn't have associates, he's high above, is highly exalted. However, we find one translator put it as, how far is Allah above those they associate with him? Well, that's not a very proper meaning, no, because when you say how far, it means again that there may be some recognition of hierarchy of gods, but God is far above. But the other proper translation really removes even any notion of comparison, and it simply says that God is exalted beyond and above all this human description or associating others with him in his divine attributes. One of the strange translations made by Lane, L-A-N-E, of verse number 93 in the second chapter of the Quran, which describes the Israelites when they disobeyed Allah and disobeyed Prophet Moses. And it says in the Arabic original, وَأُشْرِبُوا فِي قُلُوبِهِمُ الْعِجْلَةِ. The translation made by Lane, which is an erroneous one, he said, they were made to drink down the calf, C-A-L-F, the calf, into their hearts. Which is a very, very strange type of translation, because the original wording of the verse does not have anything to do with drinking, physically drinking the calf. But actually, Ushribu here means that their hearts, that is the hearts of the Israelites, were filled or soaked, drink in a sense of soaked, with the love of the calf. Because we all know the story in Sinai, when they worshipped the golden calf. But apparently, as Dr. Khalifa observes, Lewin in his translation was apparently influenced by his background, biblical background, where it states in the book of Exodus in the Bible in chapter 32 that Moses, when he came back, he was very angry, so he ordered that the calf would be burnt and to make it powder, and to mix that powder with water and ask the Israelites to drink it. But this is not the story in the Quran whatsoever, and the words of the verse has nothing to do with this kind of erroneous translation.
Now, these points are very well taken. And for that matter, it brings about another question. Many of the translators and the actual people that have translated the Quran into English come predominantly from Judeo-Christian backgrounds. Mm-hmm. How may this fact reflect in the accuracy of the translation of the Quran?
I think, in my humble understanding, that it was a very influential part in their attitudes. Because, as indicated in some previous programs, they have been an erroneous assumption that we discussed amply, that since the Quran was revealed after the Bible, then many people have wasted their lives trying to discover the so-called parallels to try to prove that the Quran is not really revelation but simply copied. And we discussed this issue amply in the topic of the authority of the Quran. But just to give a few examples of this, you might say, Judeo-Christian background in the mind of some translators, if you refer to chapter 16 in the Quran, particularly verse 15, which says, وَأَلْقَى فِي الْأَرْضِ رَوَاسِيَ أَنْ تَمِيدَ بِكُمْ, which means that God has thrown on earth mountains that are firmly rooted, lest it should move with you. Now, in the translation, which is just quoted by George Sale, he says, God's thrown on the earth, on the earth. Whereas the original text actually does not say on the earth, it says in the earth, fil ardi. Which translation actually should be corrected to read that God laid down foundations of the earth that it should not be moved or shake with you. Now, in the translation that is suggested earlier by Sale, it seems to more or less be based on the statement in the Psalms of David in Psalm 4, in chapter 4, Psalm, that's number 5, that God laid foundation on earth so that it should not move forever. And he simply tried to apply that notion to interpret the verse in the Quran, which doesn't really carry that particular meaning. Well, this perhaps requires further clarification, so our time is really getting very close.
I don't know if we
can catch up with that.
No, I'm afraid not. I think we ran out of time. In tonight's program, as we've mentioned, we have started a new topic on the translations of the Quran and hope to continue it, inshallah, next week. From all of us, assalamu alaikum.